from Louisville Public Media.
Support comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
This is Robert Siegel, former host of NPR's All Things Considered. Great Podversations features nationally recognized writers and journalists in candid conversation about books and ideas. Great Podversations is produced by the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum. It's an honor for me to continue my long relationship with this series, which televises its forums on PBS affiliates as Great Conversations. Well, today, the former commander of NATO, Admiral James Stavridis, discusses his geopolitical thriller, 2034, a novel of the next world war, with New York Times journalist and George Washington University national security professor Tom Shanker. Admiral James Stavridis spent more than 30 years in the U.S. Navy, rising to the rank of four-star admiral. He holds a Ph.D. from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, where he recently served 5 years as dean. He has published 9 previous books and hundreds of articles, and is a frequent national and international television commentator, as well as a Bloomberg International Television commentator, as well as a Bloomberg Opinion Weekly columnist and a monthly columnist for Time magazine. Tom Shanker was named director of the Project for Media and National Security at George Washington University in June 2021, after nearly 25 years with the New York Times, including 13 years as Pentagon correspondent, covering the Department of Defense, overseas combat operations, and national security policy. Most recently, he had served as deputy Washington editor for the Times, managing coverage of the military, diplomacy, and veterans affairs. Mr. Shanker is co-author of the bestseller Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. We hope you'll enjoy this great podversation with Admiral James Stavridis and Tom Shanker.
Greetings, Admiral Stavridis, or may I say Jim, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing very well, Tom. Good to be with you.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be moderating and guiding this discussion with you today. Although, as a former newspaper man, I do want to operate in a world of full disclosure. And just like all characters in your novel have fabulous backstories, you and I have a backstory as well that we should probably share. Do you want to go first, Jim, or I can if you'd rather?
No. When we both showed up in the fall of 1981, otherwise known as 1.2 million years ago, as graduate students at the Fletcher School, we became fast friends and, of particular note, studied together international security and also were part of something you came up with, the Cold War Film Festival. You might want to say a word about that.
Oh, thanks so much. When I tell people about how we first met, I do point out that one of us spent a lot of time studying in the library, earned a PhD, and graduated with the highest honors that Fletcher bestows. And one of us spent a lot of time in the music scene of the greater Boston area. And I'll let the audience figure out which one of us is which. But some of us did, and you were a great supporter, tried to bring popular culture and better understanding of national security, not just to the Fletcher community, but to the Tufts University campus. So we sponsored a Cold War Film Festival with Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove, and had a lot of guest speakers, and it was a lot of fun. It really, really was. But if I could, I'd like to turn to your fabulous and provocative and thought-provoking novel. Now, this is not your first book, Jim. Can you discuss a bit the Stavridis Library and bookshelf? I've been in the Navy Library. There's a whole shelf of doctrinal manuals written by some guy named Stavridis. So tell us about some of those.
Well, thanks, Tom. My first couple of books were about how to drive a ship, how to lead sailors at sea. They were books called The Watch Officer's Guide, How to Stand a Watch on the Bridge, The Division Officer's Guide, How to Do Leadership. As I got more senior, I wrote a book called Command at Sea about being a captain. And then I began to be more interested in writing nonfiction about history and leadership. challenges. So in particular, I wrote a book called Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans, made the oceans the character in the novel, and then went on to write another book that came out most recently, Sailing True North, 10 Admirals and the Voyager Character. So quick summary of the Stavridis bookshelf, 9 books of nonfiction. And I went to my editor and said, hey, I think it's time I tried to write a novel. So that's my 10th book.
Right. And that turned out very, very well. I can share with the listeners that a few weeks back, I was lecturing to a classroom filled with captains and majors. They were studying business strategy. And I was asked to lecture all about the 9/11 and the wars post 9/11. And near the end, one of the bright young majors said, so that's very interesting. Thanks for the lessons learned. But if we want to learn about the future of war, what should we read? And I said, there is a novel called 2034, a novel of the next world war by Elliot Ackerman and James Stavridis. Read that. And I could see them on their Kindles. I think you sold 24 copies in two minutes. So Jim, talk a little bit about 2034. Why the title? What was your commander's intent for this novel? Because clearly this was not just a lark. You had some very important things you wanted to say.
Tom, we spoke a moment ago about the Cold War Film Festival, and to be honest with you, as I was watching events unfold between the U.S. and China, it occurred to me that there was this rich body of Cold War literature, Cold War as in between the Soviet Union and United States. You mentioned a couple, Dr. Strangelove, The Bedford Incident, Red Storm Rising, The Third World War by Sir John Hackett, On the Beach by Neville Shute. These were also films. And so there was this rich body of literature. And my thesis is that a result of that, at least, was to partially deter war, because we could imagine how terrible a war would be between the United States and Soviet Union. So come back to the present. If you look at the way in which, unfortunately, the U.S. and China, I think, are moving, kind of stumbling, sleepwalking into a Cold War, there's no comparative body of literature that shows a reader how terrible it would be if we managed to stumble into a Cold War, let alone a hot war. So that was kind of the premise of the novel, show readers how terrible it would be and how easy it would be for a miscalculation in a small spot, say in the South China Sea where the novel opens, to blossom into a far wider confrontation that includes in the novel the use of tactical nuclear weapons. And by the way, I hasten to say, 2034 is not Tom Clancy in the sense that this is not good guys and bad guys, and the good guys win in the end, you know, often in the nick of time. This is not that novel. This is a novel about how easy it would be for this to occur, what it would look like, and how both nations would emerge diminished. There's no set piece villain in this other than war itself.
You know, I'm not a professional reviewer of books, but I will say that as I was reading this, your point, how this is not, you know, a beach reading techno thriller, Jim, you know, there's no decision that a democracy makes that's more grim than going to war, blood, life, treasury. And I think that grimness comes through, but in a very gripping and approachable way, and a very cautionary tale. And on that caution, Jim, I'm curious, why 2034? I have a theory, but I'd like to hear your explanation.
Well, it's a bit of an homage to George Orwell and 1984, which was a work of cautionary fiction about how terrible it would be if totalitarian, authoritarian societies dominated the social, political, and military landscape. So I knew I wanted it to end with a four. And originally, I was thinking about setting the book kind of mid-century, maybe later in the 21st century. But the more I wrote, the more I looked at events with China, the more I became concerned that this was much more of a real-time event. So we kept pulling the date backwards and ended up with 2034, which is, you know, just over a decade from now. And by the way, a lot of my contemporaries, both retired senior admirals and generals and active duty, many have said to me, you know, hey, Stavridis, you wrote a great novel, but you got one big thing wrong, the date, as in they believe this could come even sooner. And as you know, don't take my word for it, the just recently departed commander of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, Admiral Phil Davidson, in congressional open testimony, said that he can foresee a scenario in which China attacks Taiwan, which would certainly provoke some of the events in the book, as early as 5 to 6 years from now. So 2034, homage to Orwell, pulled back to about 10 years out at this point.
Well, as if we already didn't have enough reasons to lose sleep at night. That is an incredibly chilling thought, Jim. Your co-author, Elliot Ackerman, very well known to those of us who read National Security. Tell us a little bit about him. And also, how does one write a novel with a partner?
Elliot is a remarkable person. I met him through the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, just as you and I share that bond. I share that bond. You and I share that bond with Elliot. Elliot left Tufts University with a master's degree from the Fletcher School and promptly enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps, became an officer, fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's a recipient of the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart. He also was a CIA officer subsequent to his tour in the Marines. As a Marine officer, he became a CIA officer in Afghanistan and then went on to earn a White House fellowship. He's published 5 novels. His 3rd novel was shortlisted for the National Book Award, which is a very big deal, kind of the Oscars of books, if you will. And the reason we came to write a novel together, we'd known each other for much of a decade, but when I went to my publisher and to my editor, it turns out he is the same editor who edits Elliot Ackerman. And it was our editor who said, hey, I can see a book that brings together Admiral Stavridis and his geopolitical sense and his sense of military technology and how the Navy and the maritime side of this works alongside a distinguished novelist, a much more experienced novelist than I am, obviously, but who has ground experiences in the Marines. It was just kind of a natural fit together suggested by our editor. And to the question of how do you write a novel together, I suspect every writing team has a bit of a different approach. We started with a detailed outline and a proposal that I had written. That was the initial event that kicked off the partnership. Elliot then was our first drafter in each of the chapters. And as he would write a chapter, I would update the detailed outline because things change. And then we would just go back and forth till we were happy with the chapter, put that in the bank, repeat that sequence. There's only 6-7 chapters in the book. And it took us about a year to write it, going back and forth. Each chapter was a process of, you know, about a month or two. I say this, by the way, to my good friend Tom Shanker, who is no stranger to that process and has written several extraordinary books and has been a brilliant war correspondent and Pentagon correspondent. But how did you and Eric write your book together?
Much the same way. We had, you know, covered, you know, the war against Al-Qaeda for a decade. As we approached the 10th anniversary, Eric and I sort of looked at our notebooks and experience and said, you know, we have something to say here. And what we brought to Counter-Strike, to the extent that it had value in the large bookshelf of works on counterterrorism, is we brought sort of a synthetic view to the counterterrorism effort as opposed to just, you know, a chronology. And we looked at how deterrence is sort of the unused part of counterterrorism. And that, of course, has now become standard logic. But one of the other things that I've learned covering the military for 20 years from officers like you is that the military, to organize a complex world, divides it into tactical, operational, and strategic. And most of the techno thrillers err on the tactical operational side, Jim. But one of the brilliant things that you and Elliot did is your book explains this grim march to war with China, smart tactics, how do the operations play out, and then back at the White House, how the strategy was formed, or how did the strategy stumble? And that was very, very powerful to me. Before we get into some of those serious themes, though, I wanted to ask a bit of a lighter question. My wife and I raised two sons. We went to a lot of superhero movies, and all superhero movies have what they call Easter eggs. They're little things in the background that are put there only because the authors wanted to, recognized by only a couple. You mentioned Fletcher in the book. There's also an admiral named Henriksen. That's the name of the diplomacy dean at Fletcher. Any other little Easter eggs that you can share with the listeners for when they pick up this novel and read it?
Well, part of the fun, of course, is knowing what the Easter egg is, and maybe you do and maybe you don't know, but I'll give you one other one. As a proud Annapolis graduate, it shouldn't be lost on people that the most villainous character in the book is at the National Security Council staff. He's the National Security Advisor, and he is a graduate of West Point.
Well, we'll think about that when they face off in football this season as well. You know, Jim, you mentioned national security, and one of the themes that really emerges from this book is this nation's dependence on legacy weapons. And legacy weapons is a polite word for the old stuff. So how does America's reliance on legacy weapons and perhaps failure to invest in the next generation of weapons because of all the money spent on counterterrorism for the past 20 years, how do you think that sets this nation up at great risk?
This, of course, is unpackaged in the first chapter of the book, which ends with a massive cyber attack launched by China that effectively blinks the entire United States. And it becomes one of these events like 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. You can always remember where you were when John F. Kennedy was shot. In the novel, you can, going forward, always remember where you were when the entire cyber system blinks. It's a demonstration by China of their power in this venue. And unfortunately, Tom, your observation is quite apt that we have invested enormously in these legacy systems. Big aircraft carriers, fifth generation fighters, our high-end tanks and armor, all of that. And perhaps it will have a role to play for our security. But the tools of warfare in this 21st century, as we demonstrate in 2034, are cyber, both offensive and defensive, space and space operations. I applaud the creation of U.S. Space Force, by the way. Unmanned vehicles to include drones, high altitude, bottom of the sea, and special forces who play an interesting and significant role in this. Those, I think, are the new coin of the realm in terms of 21st century war. Now, it doesn't mean that this is an on and off switch and that you just stop procuring these legacy systems and suddenly throw your entire defense budget at these new weapons of war. It's kind of a rheostat. You have to kind of dial it in. And I think we're starting now, and this is part of wrapping up these forever wars, to move the dial of procurement and acquisition toward the systems I just mentioned. Let's hope we continue to do that, or we will find ourselves in a very disadvantageous position in 2034.
And for those who are listening or for those who read the book and come away with deep pessimism, I will point out from experience that they should have faith in some of the great minds in the American military. I have a quick Jim Stavridis story. You might not even remember this, Jim, but you know, I had just come to the Pentagon for the New York Times after my 5 years in Moscow and years covering Bosnia. And our first interview, you were a one-star admiral running Deep Blue, which was the Navy's super secret think tank, the biggest brains in the service. And you told Eric and me, you mentioned him earlier, we were side-by-side Pentagon reporting partners, that you were working on an idea to reconfigure the P-3 Orion, which was just a jewel of a Navy aircraft designed for hunting Soviet submarines underwater during the Cold War. But Rear Admiral Stavridis had the idea, can we reconfigure them not to hunt for submarines underwater, but for Taliban in the deserts of Afghanistan? So you were able to torque a legacy system into the needs of the post 9/11 world. And do you have hope that that effort is continuing?
I have not only hope, I have certainty that it is. As I look at the current generation of particularly younger flag officers, younger admirals and generals, they are more than ready to move on from this series of events, this 20-year Cold War, if you will, against terrorism and hot war against terrorism. They're ready to take on the challenges of great power competition. That means facing Chinese and Russian systems, principally operating in opposed environments. As you know, the reason we could operate a P-3 over Afghanistan or over Iraq was that our opponents really didn't have the technology to knock those things down. They didn't have sophisticated air defense systems, and we could suppress the handheld system. So you adapt to war, and I'll give you a very quick historical story from 700 years ago. And this is the Battle of Agincourt, where the French knights are imbued with the most powerful technology of the day, plate armor. And they are covered with it head to foot, and they know they are invulnerable. And they are battling the English. And at a muddy field in Agincourt, they ride in their high-tech armor, and they are slaughtered, destroyed by English bowmen with longbows, no armor. It's the way technology moves. You have to adapt to it and not find yourself in the role of the French knights.
Mm-hmm. And just for the record, you were not in command there, nor was I a correspondent covering that.
Exactly. No, I got there around the time of the Battle of Trafalgar.
There you go. But your point is interesting as well, that it's, you know, at the end of the day, militaries may march on their belly and use technology, but it's the leaders who make all the difference. And I think that comes through in this book as well. Is there a lesson or two for future military leaders from your novel that you can share with us?
Well, let me make a point from current events, which is what just happened in Afghanistan, a story you and I know all too well. And here you see the U.S. military go in and create a pretty modern army of Afghanistan, 300,000 strong, that looks a lot like the U.S. Army, which is to say, dependent on exquisite intelligence, counting on air medevac, absolutely consumed with precision fires, reducing collateral damage, highly armored in the context of fighting in Afghanistan, mechanized, et cetera, et cetera. As the U.S. pulled out, and we could have a debate about how that has unfolded, but as the U.S. pulled out, that army lost its confidence. It lost, more importantly, its access to all of those key enablers. And the Taliban, in their Nissan pickups and their zero armor, wearing tennis shoes and flip-flops, defeated that Afghan army, which melted away. It's also a story not only of bad technology and poor theory in how we trained that army, and I am part of that, and I take ownership for that, but it is also an example of the point you just made, that leadership matters in war. As the saying goes, I would rather have a flock of lambs led by a lion to go into war than a flock of lions led by a lamb. So plenty of deconstruction and lessons learned would be drawn from what happened to Afghanistan, but there's both a technology lesson there and a leadership lesson there. And I think both of those echo in the novel 2034 on both sides, U.S. and China.
I think both in the collapse of Afghanistan that we're witnessing in real time and in your novel, it seems that humility should be in every leader's toolbox as well.
Absolutely. The top of the list. And, you know, the Greeks, as always, have a word for the opposite, which is hubris. that's the tool you want to get rid of as early in your career development as you possibly can. And that means you are unafraid to ascribe real talent, real brilliance, real determination to your opponents. Do not underestimate them. The enemy gets a vote in war. We saw that here in Afghanistan. We certainly see that in the novel. And if you fail to learn those lessons, you are going to be defeated or diminished significantly.
Hmm. Your final military command before retiring probably has the coolest name in the entire military, Supreme Allied Commander Europe. In layman's term, you were NATO commander. You had to wrestle a couple of dozen allies, both for Afghanistan and for the defense of Europe. You know, we're living in a, I don't want to get partisan and political here, Jim, but we're living in the aftermath of some American leadership that did not exactly curate and protect our alliances. Let's just leave it at that. Your experience, especially as played out in your novel 2034, talk about the importance of allies, if you would.
Yeah, one of the, I hope, striking aspects of the cautionary tale here is U.S. and China end up going to war. China goes to war with allies. They go to war with Russia. They go to war with Iran alongside them. The United States, in the novel 2034, zero allies. You ought to be reading that novel saying to yourself, wait a minute, where's NATO? What happened to an attack on one is an attack on all? Where are the Japanese? Where are the Australians? Where are the South Koreans and our other Pacific allies? Where are our European allies? They're not in the novel. And recall, we were writing this book two and a half years ago when we watched the Trump administration, I don't think it's too strong a word, denigrate NATO, disrespect it, talk about how it really might not be a good value for the United States. We watched the Trump administration go to both Japan and South Korea with extremely high levels of demands for payments in order to keep our soldiers and sailors in bases in their defense. You know, that's not how you treat allies. You know, having said all that, should the allies spend a bit more on defense? I absolutely agree they should, the Europeans in particular. Should our allies shoulder a significant part of the burden of hosting our troops overseas? Yes, I believe that. But I'm with Winston Churchill on this one, which is to say, the only thing worse than having to fight a war with all the complexities of an alliance structure, the only thing worse is fighting a war without allies. And that is the unenviable position in which the United States finds itself in 2034. Bottom line, alliances are perhaps our greatest comparative advantage in the world. And secondly, they're like a garden. If you don't tend the garden, it will wither away. And we saw the edges of that toward the end of the Trump administration. I think this is rightly a real focus of the Biden team to try and bring these alliances back fully into bloom.
You mentioned China's ally, Russia, in the novel, and it was one of the most chilling parts of the book. And I say that not just because I spent 5 years as a correspondent there, a time my wife recalls as five winters, of course. But Russia plays a very, very critical disruptor role, not so much in furthering China's policy, but for its own. And the one major Russian military operation in the book actually escalates the tensions between the U.S. and China to a catastrophic end that nobody could have anticipated.
It does. And I'll go ahead and do a spoiler here. It's an attack on the underwater cables that carry the internet. Many listeners might think the internet is perhaps a part of the electrical system in your house, or maybe it's beamed down from satellites. 95%+ of the information that flows on the internet moves on submarine cables, cables at the bottom of the ocean. There's only about 300 of them. They're a immense checkpoint, a real vulnerability in my view. And in the novel, Russia, playing the role that Vladimir Putin has embraced. And by the way, Vladimir Putin is still alive in this novel, in his 80s, still throwing sand in the gears wherever he can. In the novel, the Russians go after undersea cables at a very inopportune moment that creates further tension between the U.S. and China, leading to a dramatic escalation. Could that happen? You bet.
And what you really captured, you said, you know, throwing sand in the gears. It's, you know, Russia, like all weak powers, is playing to its strength, which is to disrupt the national security interests of other nations in indirect manners. And Jim, you in this novel just captured that perfectly. In the scenario of your novel, and I need to put you on the spot here, if you were the only bad guy in the novel, the only villain who is the West Point graduate, national security advisor, what would you or what could you have done differently with the array of facts on the ground that flowed to the first female president of the United States?
I think without question, your answer is embedded in the way you articulated the question. It's all about the flow of information. A national security advisor is charged with ideas, concepts, and the flow of information. And that means getting all competing viewpoints on the table in front of the president and the other members of the National Security Council, the vice president, secretary of state, secretary of defense, director of central intelligence, and so forth. Think of the national security advisor as someone who shepherds the interagency, but in particular is charged with getting the ideas coherently in front of the president, not just his or her idea, the ideas of all. And so if you think of the best national security advisors, they might or might not be extremely well known. One I have a lot of regard for is Stephen Hadley, who was the national security advisor for President Bush in his second term. Superbly even-handed, calm under pressure, brought ideas, packaged them, and allowed the principals to make the decisions. That's the kind of national security advisor you need to be. The national security advisor in the novel, as you're reading what he's doing, you ought to be literally screaming at the page, "No, stop. You can't keep those facts away from the president." And in this case, it's a member of his own National Security Council staff that he physically restrains, even as the president struggles to make decisions that are going to cost millions of American and Chinese lives. It's a moment in the novel where you really want to just reach your hand into the book and pull the keys out of the car. But I'll tell you, and you know this as well as I do, Tom, having spent so much of your professional life in Washington, in the Pentagon, you know that big doors swing on small hinges. And what I mean by that is, don't underestimate the power of a single staffer, maybe a mid-career person, and their importance in moving an idea or a small but vital fact forward. And conversely, what if that person is out sick? What if that person has a daycare problem that day? What if that person has a personality conflict with their immediate boss or the boss two levels higher? What if the boss just doesn't like to hear things from a person of color, which is the case here? Those are real impediments to national security. By being aware of them, we can create the kind of system that moves the information to the decision makers. In this case, the president of the United States is shortchanged in terms of all the information she needs to make coherent decisions.
Well, we should type up that advice, Jim, and give it to every president who's selecting their next national security advisor. That's incredibly wise. I have one last question for you. One last question, and I think probably save the toughest one for last. It's a very powerful book. It's gripping. It's a great read as well as thought-provoking. But how can we avoid the conflict with China? Is it already written? Is it preordained? Is it too late? If you were that national security advisor, what can we do? What should we do today to prevent the novel 2034 from happening?
Thank you, because that is the gut question that I hope remains when you've read the book. The book does not provide the prescription. The book surfaces the challenges and the questions and helps us imagine how terrible it would be. It then becomes incumbent upon us to reverse engineer ourselves back from 2034 and say, this is 2021. What do we need to do right now? And I'll give you a quick sketch. We need to start by learning, studying, and empathizing with China. That means reading not only Henry Kissinger's magisterial treatment on China, but also read the literature of China, read the current pronouncements of Chinese leadership, understand how that connects with the history and the culture. We need to increase every aspect of our knowledge of China, because I assure you, China knows more about the United States than we do about China. Job one. Then we need to bring together the experts and construct a strategy. And that strategy, like all good strategies, ought to have a military component. We need to be able to deter China. That means the kind of investments we talked about. We need a diplomatic strategy that tends the garden of our alliances, because we are stronger together than standing alone. We need a tech strategy as distinct from the military piece, some connection there, but ensuring that we can compete with China in artificial intelligence, quantum computing, social networking. All of these are skills in the tech world. We need a strategy. And by the way, that'll include onshoring critical supply chains. And fourth, Tom, we need to recognize it's a values-based competition. We've got to walk our talk on democracy, on gender equality, on racial equality. Those are the right values. We execute them imperfectly, but they are the right values, and they are competing with a different set of offerings from China and Russia, authoritarians. So knowledge, military, our ability to have tech capability, our alliance systems, and our values are key to all of this. If we do that well, we construct it as a strategy, we can avoid the events of 2034.
So much to think about in the days and months and years ahead. Admiral James Stavridis, co-author with Elliot Ackerman of 2034, A Novel of the Next World War. Jim, it was a real treat and an honor. Thank you so much.
Last thought. People say to me a lot, Admiral, thank you for your service. Tom, as I have been watching these last few weeks, these intrepid reporters in Afghanistan risking their lives minute by minute to show us what is happening. You've had a lifetime of doing that. We ought to stop and say thank you for your service to the journalists who are forward, at risk, and living the values, in this case, freedom of the press, which is part of what we just talked about with China. So my friend, thank you for a lifetime of service as a journalist.
And to all of our colleagues in the field, both in uniform and those just carrying pads and pens. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend.
Please visit KentuckyAuthorForum.com for more information and for show notes on today's podcast. And please take a minute to rate and review Great Podversations in your podcast app. Great Podversations is distributed by Louisville Public Media. It's a production of the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum. Mary Moss Greenbaum, producer, Evie Clare, associate producer, and Leslie Sissel, consultant. Great Podversations is supported by Bittner's, Brown-Forman Foundation, the Geans Foundation, James Graham Brown Foundation, and LDG Development. We hope you enjoyed this Great Podversation. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to your joining me for the next Great Podversation.
Support comes from Podchaser. the place where podcast listeners go to discover new shows, review their favorites, create playlists, follow friends, and more. Sign up for free at podchaser.com.
The news never stops, but sometimes you need to. Follow the WFPL Daily News Briefing Podcast, and we'll get you back up to speed every morning. Follow us here in your podcast app or see more at wfpl.org/daily news.